Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Greetings, Father Daniel. I recently saw you on the golf course where you are not very good.
I agree. Gosh.
I've also seen you on the Frisbee golf course where you are very good.
I'm much better at disc golf than I am at ball golf.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
I spend more time there. I enjoy disc golf more than I do golf, but I'm getting a little bit better. I'm not as bad as I used to be, but I'm still pretty bad. A few years ago, there was a priest who told me, you can have one of two things. You can either be a good priest or a good golfer, but not both. So I chose to be a good priest. At least I'm trying to be a good priest.
You're a good priest and a good disc golfer.
I'm a good disc golfer, but that's my outlet for exercise.
Love it. A 2025 Pew Research Center survey of U.S. adults examined 15 behaviors to determine what Americans consider immoral.
Okay.
Among the results were the following. 90% of U.S. adults say adultery is morally wrong, which was by far the strongest consensus on any behavior tested. Hmm. This puts Americans on par with Indonesia and Turkey, who are at 92% each on the issue of adultery. While Germany and France are at the opposite end, they are at 55 and 53%, so only half of their populations consider extramarital affairs to be morally unacceptable.
Interesting.
Reflecting on these results, it's clear that adultery hits a near universal nerve in the U.S., but it's interesting that in other countries, not so much. So I was thinking, why could this be? So Germany and America are both liberal democracies, but they arrived at liberalism through very different means. America's culture was shaped heavily by the Puritan traditions that internalized morality and tied sexual ethics to personal virtue and salvation. The culture emerged where private behavior was somewhat subject to moral judgment by the community, whereas Germany's experience with Nazism, a regime that was intensely moralistic and policed private life, seems to have left a lasting cultural wariness of collective moral judgment. So I'm going to first ask you about Germany. There's this residual cultural instinct there that seems to be, who are we to declare what's wrong or morally wrong in someone's private life? What do you think about the difference between Germany and America first?
Well, I don't know that I would agree with the narrative of how each country arrived to where it is, the causal factors, at least my read of German society. And I have never lived in Germany, but my ancestors are from there. And I know a lot of priests who do work in Germany. I think there's some other factors that are coming into play. And it may not have to do so much with Nazism, because frankly, under National Socialism, there was a lot of debauchery. And there was actually a breakdown of family structure
by the government or
yes.
By the citizenry?
No, by the government.
Right. Well, so we're talking about the citizenry here, the broader citizenry.
Well, the citizenry in Germany, at least up until the 1500s, was solidly Catholic. And then you had the introduction of Protestantism under Martin Luther, which, it basically polarized the country. You had the Catholic sections of the country because they're
Protestant North, Catholic South.
Essentially, it was a little bit more nuanced than that, but that's essentially what it was. So you had a lot of internal tensions within Germany. So I think the causes that led to why they adopt, or they're less, look less askance at adultery would be a little bit more complex than what you laid out.
Well, let's talk about France. I think that one's the more interesting case.
It is.
France, as, just like America, it's a republic founded on liberty and individual rights. Yet they look at, and we've always... I didn't need this Pew research to tell me that I know that they look at adultery differently.
Mm-hmm.
So during the French Revolution, the church and the monarchy were so intertwined that attacking one meant attacking the other. Their revolution was not just an attack on government, but on the entire civil order, including the church and traditional family structures,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting, right? Because that's what we have going on in America today.
That's right.
So the result was a far more aggressive than American church separation, church and state separation. So religion is actively pushed out of any public moral discourse in France. Private sexual behavior judged through a religious lens is seen as a clerical imposition and not moral intuition. So we in America, or like I just said, seem to be transitioning from the traditional moral framework that's rooted in religion that treats certain acts as intrinsically wrong to the secular moral framework built around consent, autonomy, and identifiable harm.
Mm-hmm.
But at least for now, adultery is still seemingly universally wrong in America. Is this going to last much longer?
I think it will shift as the Christian worldview is diminished in any society. I mean, those societies that you're referencing, Germany, France, in many respects, they've been de-Christianized. I mean, my sister-in-law is from France. She grew up as an atheist there. And when, you know, growing up, that was kind of like everything went, you know? And part of the reason why she converted to Catholicism was, when I asked her about it years later, she said there were two things that brought me to the Catholic Church. One was beauty, and the other was forgiveness. And I think for a lot of people who are coming to the Catholic Church these days, they're seeing in the Catholic Church a solidity when all these things are in flux in the world around us, and they're leading to broken lives, dysfunction, the breakdown of families. These are not good results in any society. And wherever the Christian worldview breaks down, these are the results. And wherever Christianity takes deep root and we really truly believe in Christ and in the way of life that he has laid out for us, a family structure is stronger, there's greater joy, there's happiness. And not that everything's perfect, but statistically, many, many things are much better.
Well, I wonder what French family life was like prior to the French Revolution. It may have, you know, they were still in name a very Catholic country, but yes. I'm sure it wasn't authentically Catholic. And well, that archetype of French lover,
what do you mean,
you know?
By authentically Catholic? I mean, we can get an argument about what that actually entails. I mean, authentically Catholic means it's messy, at least in my mind. Sometimes we have this almost, you know, going back to what you said about the foundations of our own country, we have somewhat of this, you know, puritanical view of life. It's like authentic Catholic is all perfect and there's no problems. That's a utopia. That's not real. I mean, authentic Catholic life means that life is messy and that you're going to work through things and you're going to have to forgive. And we have confession. No other Protestant denomination has confession like we have as Catholics, because we recognize that life is messy and we've got to get up and go again, you know, and we try more and we ask God for his grace. So I think an authentically Catholic life is kind of like okay with a bit of the messiness and
yeah,
working towards the ideal.
Yeah, but I wonder what French, you know what I'm talking about, the French archetype of the French lover, and it's almost like almost like, you know, add a boy if you have a lover on the side in a marriage in France. I wonder what it was like leading up to the French Revolution. And I mean, when I say authentically Catholic, obviously most of the citizenry was not, since so much of it rebelled against the order of the Catholic Church, right? Had they been authentically Catholic, they would not have rebelled against any, traditional family structures and whatnot. So I wonder what it was
like. It's complex than that, though, too. I mean, you had a small minority in France during the French Revolution that were ideologically driven. And they were driven by ideas that were anti-Catholic, anti-clerical, but also anti-monarchy. And they were seeking power for themselves. And so you have all kinds of complex factors that are present there in the French Revolution. So I don't think I would simplistically say that it was, let's break down the family or let's attack the Catholic Church. In some ways, those were byproducts. And for some people, the target was the Catholic Church. Some, the target was the monarchy. End result is it destabilized French society. And the results of the French Revolution are really, really problematic. I mean, anyone who really actually studies the French Revolution and the after effects of it, and it destroyed French society, and for generations to come, it was very problematic.
Well, hopefully, at least we can count on people universally agreeing here in America for, you know, the foreseeable future and much longer that adultery is wrong.
I certainly hope so. And the key to this, Chris, is really understanding what Jesus said. What God has joined together, let no man put asunder.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. By a vote of 8-1 on March 31st, the Supreme Court sided with a licensed Colorado therapist who challenged the state's ban on conversion therapy, ruling that the ban discriminates against her based on the views she expressed in her talk therapy. The court held that Colorado's ban censors speech based on viewpoint, since it bars therapists from speaking in any way that attempts to change a client's sexual orientation or gender identity, while permitting therapists to affirm those identities. The court rejected Colorado, the state of Colorado's argument that the ban targets conduct or medical treatments rather than speech. So while this seems like a logical result, especially considering the lopsided 8-1 vote, Justice Elena Kagan points out that in her concurring opinion that mirror image laws seeking to ban gender-affirming therapy could face the same First Amendment issues. So this seems to me to be an exercise in whether there can be such a thing as accepted standards in medicine. So doctors can lose their licenses for recommending unproven cancer treatments, for example. Nobody would seriously argue that it's unconstitutional just because it involves speech. So this ruling exposes this unresolved problem. Who decides what counts as an accepted medical practice for First Amendment purposes? And can the government use that determination to suppress one side of an ongoing social debate? So the same court recently let states ban gender-affirming care, which major medical bodies endorse, while now limiting states' ability to ban conversion therapy, which major medical bodies condemn. Major medical bodies condemn conversion therapy. So there's this tension that's based in, I think, a recognition of objective truths.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
I would take it to a slightly different approach to the question of the conversion therapies, because this is an issue that I studied in the first book that I wrote, because the debate was hot at that time. It was before the banning of some of these conversion therapies. There were a number, like Dr. Nicolosi, I think, was one of the key proponents of this. They were testing these ways of helping people who were experiencing homosexual tendencies to basically change their tendencies. And it was controversial within the homosexual community at the time, because they said, well, we want to embrace these tendencies instead of like turning away from them. And what they found in the clinical practice and research was that the therapies were actually quite effective for people who did want to get rid of the homosexual tendencies. They actually did. And they were able to marry, live a normal heterosexual life, raise children, and they were very happy with that. What the problem was within the homosexual rights activist groups, they did not want the narrative to be out there that this could be fixed or cured. They wanted to promote the narrative that this was genetically determined, that there was no freedom involved with it. And so the conversion therapies flew in the face of their spinning of the narrative. So they were trying to hide the facts. And this is, I think, the real underlying issue, not so much the free speech part of it. I think the real underlying issue is the suppression of medical and psychological data because it doesn't correspond to the worldview that you're trying to promote. And having talked with people who work in this realm, and as a priest, I've had to work with people and had the opportunity to help people who are struggling with these type of tendencies. And conversion therapies do work. Okay, because they address the underlying issues that have brought a person to that way of approaching life. So I think that's the underlying thing we need to look at.
I have one comment on that. I mean, you may or may not agree with me. I do believe that certain people are born with homosexual tendencies by genetics.
I disagree.
And I figured you would.
Based on the studies that I've done on on the topic.
But I think that's an extreme minority of individuals. But what I think affirms what you just spoke about is the possibility of influencing folks are the number of people who go down the sexual rabbit hole where they're not satiated by, you know, they're always looking for the next thing.
Right.
Look at Hugh Hefner, mm-hmm. who was certainly heterosexual.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of his life, he was into, because everything
dabbling
else had
everything.
Been, he was in dabbling in gay porn and mm-hmm. homosexuality because everything else had been done.
Right.
That right there tells you that there is a potential for change.
Clearly, yeah. And I was working with people who are struggling with different sexual addictions or pornography addictions. There is a pathway for being free of that. But the more you go into it, the more addicted and imprisoned you become. So I think we need to look at the data on this.
I didn't want to go down whether or not there is or is. It was more about this lack of recognition of objective truths. I mean, once you start, you know, I mean, in the medical field, once you start going down there, as in every field, but it's so important in the medical field, without of rejecting certain objective truths, everything is fair play.
Well, that's the key of what we're looking for in science, that science will actually look at the data and not merely the narratives that a political faction wants to spin on something. If science gets caught up in the politics of things, that's really problematic. Science needs to be able to look at the data and then interpret the data and come up with different theories that help us to understand reality based on the data that we're actually seeing.
But first and foremost, they need to be able to state up front, there are objective truths, that there are two genders, male and female.
Right.
Objective truth.
Yes, I totally agreed. And but going into, I mean, you brought up the point of like, oh, I think that some of this might be genetically determined. That gets a little bit confusing. Are there people who are like intersex? Yes, there are cases where there's genetic confusion. People are born with the phenotype of both male and female. Are they intersex? Yes. The Catholic Church actually deals with that. There are documents of the church that deal with the bioethics aspects of these strange phenomena, which are not normal. The normal is that there's a male and a female, but there are rare occasions, and the church does allow in those cases for surgeries for the person to align with their chromosomal sex. Okay. Chromosomes are always XX and XY, and that gives us a clear determination for two sexes.
Pretty objective.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
A recent Wall Street Journal opinion piece entitled, "I'm Gay, But That Doesn't Make Me Queer," is by a gay man who argues that his sexual orientation does not obligate him to adopt the, quote, queer identity and its associated ideology. He talks about how he was fired up in his younger years as an advocate for gay marriage after dropping out of college. He decided to go back for his degree as he wanted to do work on behalf of gay people, but needed more than slogans and passion. He needed an education. So in his 30s, he enrolls at Columbia University's School of General Studies, and he took courses such as U.S. Lesbian and Gay History and Muslim Masculinities. So before Columbia, he dismissed right-wing complaints about queer, post-colonial, critical race, and other critical theories as culture war hysteria. But he quickly realized that in Ivy League humanities classrooms, critical theories aren't fringe ideas. They are foundational ideologies with real-world political ambitions. So he saw critical theory treating moral norms and common sense as products of power, i.e., the only reason we believe certain things are true is because it serves the interest of the dominant groups. So queer theory applies this approach to sexuality by framing sexual identity as a site of resistance. Early on, he was told that the idea of queer is whatever is at odds with the normal, the legitimate, the dominant. So I think immediately about the BLM movement, Black Lives Matter, and how oddly on their front page, when they first came out and became a popular movement, they rejected heteronormativity. I was like, what the heck does that have to do with Black Lives Matters? And it's because it was rejecting anything that is the norm right? So he started to diverge from the indoctrination that he was receiving, as he felt most gay people were just seeking what minorities have long sought, which is safety, dignity, and the freedom to live ordinary lives. Queer politics, by contrast, encouraged deviation from social norms. So seen through this lens, contemporary phenomena that appear baffling, like what I just mentioned, begin to make sense. So the members of Queers for Palestine know that Hamas would imprison or execute them for their sexuality, but they share a common enemy in Israel and America. Liberal democracy, capitalism, and notions of universal truth have become the primary enemy. Sexual politics is merely one front in the broader civilizational struggle. So following our last topic about differing views, you know, on conversion therapy, another topic we had recently done about, you know, the French Revolution, these humanities studies at Ivy League schools sound a lot like they're trying to get us to do the French Revolution, reject norms.
Yes, yeah, and isn't that always the the tendency of the evil one. He wants to incite rebellion and rejection of truth, because Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. And whenever we see those manifestations of rebellion and rejection of truth, we know the common source.
And what you just said, I think, is so important, that we are able to, if you can step back and try to figure out what the evil one is trying to do here in all of our, you know, political discourse, and it's in other things as well, it becomes a little, you know, simpler to see, oh, I know what's going on now, right?
Yeah.
Because I was, like I said, just baffled by the Black Lives Matter movement front page rejecting heteronormativity. I just didn't get, where the heck did that come from?
Yeah, well, it's bizarre.
Yeah, and it's making more sense to me, you know, this and some of the other things that some of the left side of the aisle are advocating. Yeah. It makes a little more sense to me. Just reject any, back to objective truths, reject objective truths.
Yeah. Do you remember that movie that came out a couple of years ago? It was supposedly classified as a horror movie, but it was about a guy who was in prison. He was going to be put to death.
Oh, yeah.
What's that one called?
The one where he's possessed?
Yeah, he's possessed, and the lawyer comes in, and he's questioning him, and he's starting to do these paranormal things.
Yes.
I forget the title of it right now, but this is the problem when you always put me on the spot. I can't research the things. But that movie, the dialogue between the guy who's possessed by this legion of demons.
Which was based on a true story, supposedly.
Yeah, yeah. The dialogue when he talks about how he will undermine society by challenging truth and inciting rebellion, it is so spot on with how the devil has worked throughout history.
Oh,
talk with any exorcist, this is the reality you've seen. And sometimes we see all these things that are going on in as political or, you know, scientific studies or fringe stuff. Yeah, there's that element, but there's also, as St. Paul says, our battle is against the principalities and powers of this world. Not to over-demonize the world, and you know, but at the same time, we have to recognize that there is a reality there. Going back to the theories, you know, queer theory versus gay versus homosexual tendencies, I would venture more that, you know, at least in the studies that I've done on this topic, you know, people who are suffering from a tendency towards attraction to someone of the same sex. Okay, that they experience that from, you know, their upbringing and the experiences that they've had, and many of them experience it as a suffering, as something that they don't want. That's where I would distinguish between homosexual tendencies as the first start, the beginning of this this pathway, if you will, to gay, someone who takes on the identity, says, yes, I am homosexual, I'm going to live according to this, then to what you described as queer, those who would just challenge anything,
reject everything,
and reject it all and burn it all down.
Right.
There's very few people that would fit into that category of
queer. I suspect that this guy is like most of folks who consider themselves to be homosexual, that, you know, that doesn't mean they're signing up for everything. It's like when we talked about the Iranian Revolution, where, wait, what happened? You know, it just got hijacked.
Right.
You know, we didn't mean we're signing up for all of this.
Yeah. And I've had deep conversations over the years with many people who are living a gay lifestyle or have come out of a gay lifestyle, and they would recognize this clear differentiation of three levels. Most of them do not want to be in that third level of queer at all. Some of them embrace the homosexual gay lifestyle because they don't see any other way. But then there's many others who say, you know what, I don't even want these tendencies. And they work with that conversion therapy. There's a famous book that came out a number of years ago, Why I Don't Call Myself Gay. Really insightful book from Ignatius Press about a gentleman who struggled with homosexual and lived a gay lifestyle for many years of his life, was able to break free of that. And even though sometimes the tendency, the attractions didn't necessarily go away, but he's able to live a life more in accord with the teachings of the church. And Chris, let's just put it in this context. You know, we all have sexual tendencies.
We all have multiple different tendencies,
that's
sexual
right.
and otherwise.
Yeah.
That you have to govern.
That's
and
right.
live in the mean, the golden mean.
That's exactly right. And our sexual tendencies don't define our identity. That's just one little piece of who we
Amen.
Are. We need to look at the bigger picture of who we are as sons and daughters of God.
crossed wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
The Dominican Sisters of Hawthorne have cared for the terminally ill poor for more than 120 years in New York State, but they are now suing the state over a 2024 law that requires long-term care facilities to cater to a patient's so-called gender identity in conversation, rooming assignments, and bathroom use. The nuns say, "We have never had anybody complain, and we cannot implement New York's mandate without violating our Catholic faith." The law in question is called the LGBTQ Long-Term Care Facility Residents Bill of Rights. So can't the legislators come up with a more meaningful issue to tackle than this? But anyways, the law requires patients to use whatever restroom they prefer, even if their roommates object, and the caretakers must...
Wait a second. I'm a little confused here, Chris. From what I know from nursing homes, a lot of people aren't even using the restroom anymore. Well, they're using diapers.
Yeah. Well, if they can. Okay.
Gotcha.
But more importantly, here I think more ridiculously rather, is that caretakers must always refer to patients using their preferred pronouns, even if the patient is not present. If a caretaker commits a willful violation, they may face up to a $10,000 fine and a year in prison. Notably, the law in New York provides a religious exemption for long-term care facilities operated by Church of Christ Scientists, but not those run by Catholics or other denominations. So, I mean, really, New York? Like, is this what you're wasting your time on? I mean, don't they have, you know, budget deficits to tackle and, you know?
Oh, they do. And that's
and electricity prices
are
and
fleeing the state because the legislators are caught up in this type of ridiculousness. It reminds me of an article that I just read. I forget what the phrase is in Latin. But it's the expression is something along the lines of noted and it will be ignored.
Right.
I mean, sometimes this type of legislation, like how are they going to enforce something like that? Just ignore it and move on.
But how about this exemption that they provided for Church of Christ Scientists, but not for Catholics? I mean, New York has such a long, rich. I mean, when you go to New York, there's, you know, it's not like throughout the South where most of the churches are, you know, Protestant churches.
Right.
I mean,
it's Catholic churches
everywhere. Right. And, you know, shooting themselves in the foot here with these nuns who provide free care.
Yeah, well, it's a way to, you know, further push society in a certain direction according to the ideology. There's their preferred worldview. So we just need to bring things back to some common sense.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.